Good morning. Welcome to our quarterly podcast. I'm David Rothberg, and with me is the portfolio manager of the Freeburg Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Asset Allocation Fund. It's my great pleasure to say hello to you, Albert. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm fine. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
You're in sunny Miami. I'm in very, very wintry Montreal.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary weather, and it's also extraordinary markets, and in particular, an extraordinary precious metals market. I think that this quarter, we're recording this on the 28th of January on Wednesday morning. I think that this quarter, the one thing to talk about is the gold market itself. And the extraordinary comments you make about trading the gold market in your quarterly letter, in my opinion, an astounding piece that you've written about the nature of trading and how you see the investment process. And and the implication, of course, is that it's that process that you've used to capitalize on this extraordinary market, capitalize to the extent that the returns are really outsized. They are as extraordinary as the market itself. So let's begin by talking about gold and about silver and about precious metals. It's a position that you've held for an awfully long time. The position has been based fundamentally on the idea of the debasement, not just of the dollar, but of fiat currencies in aggregate. That kind of trade has been called the debasement trade. The trade, while it's existed for an awfully long time, has entered now an accelerated phase. How do you see it? How do you see yourself positioned now? How do you see the market itself being positioned?
Right. So debasement is not a great explanation for what's happening, because I guess we've been having debasement for a long time, and gold did not necessarily react very well to that whole process of debasement. I mean, just to take the debasement theme a little further, it's not just that. I mean, if we look at the inflation rates today, are not a lot different than they were 30 years ago or 40 years ago. It's more the fact that governments don't care anymore. You know, there was a time in which we talked about deficits and taxes and spending cuts and so on. And there was a kind of a nervousness about the fact that we may not be able one day to meet Social Security payments or other pension liabilities. There was a concern that existed. That existed 15 years ago or 20 years ago. But I think that the world has given up on that. It's not just the U.S. I think almost the entire world has given up on that. I don't think that these democratic governments anymore care about what will happen after their term expires and the next guy comes and another 4 years. But I don't think anybody cares as to what will happen. And they issued debt and a lot of debt. And so it's not so much a debasement, the present debasement. Clearly, the present debasement is not that terrible. And if it were terrible, you'd see it in interest rates, right? You see it in 10-year bonds. I mean, the 10-year bonds should not be trading with a 4.3 yield when you really think that there's an alarming debasement going on. So at least a substantial part of the market doesn't think that we are going off the rails in terms of inflation. It's more like the idea that there will be a point sometime, you know, I don't know, could be 10, could be 20 years from now, where that debt will not be able to be paid. And that would imply at that point a serious debasement at that point. Right. So So there's a fear that there will be debasement sometime in the future. So I think debasement should be seen in that light. It's not debasement at the moment, but the fact that nobody cares, nobody cares about deficits, and therefore the debt accumulates, and when it accumulates, at some point it will make it impossible to be repaid unless you just decide not to pay for it or print enough money to pay for it. But right now, David, I think that it's more than just that. I think it's more than just that fear. And that's like a more, that's a kind of fear that people don't have easily, right? Because if you tell somebody that he's going to hell if he does certain things, well, hell is so far away from here and so remote that it doesn't act as a constraint on a person. You know, if it's very far away, it doesn't act as a constraint. If Social Security will fail at some point in the future, well, if it's 30, 40, 50 years away, who cares? You know, nobody really cares about it today. So that fear should not be the one driving gold. What is driving gold really is fragmentation. And this political fragmentation, which is in a way some form of deglobalization, for better or for worse. I mean, I don't want to get into the details and the meaning, the semantics of it now. But this fragmentation of the world, where we are creating these political military blocks, independent blocks around, and where almost everybody is like they would say in French in Montreal, they say "sauf qui peut," right? Whoever can save himself should jump on the boat. That type of political fragmentation is starting, it started about 15 years ago when we saw central banks around the world buying gold. And I think I'm not sure that if I own, at that time it was simple. That time was a simple question. I have international reserves. I use them from time to time. I have dollars in reserves because that's the most traded currency. That's the one I need. And what do I do with the dollars? Well, I buy bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds. That's usually what I buy. So most of those reserves were in U.S. Treasury bonds. So that was a simple thing maybe 15 years ago. And then the thought was, well, maybe we shouldn't have that many U.S. dollar bonds because who knows, maybe the day will come. But that was still a far thought. But maybe the day will come then that the U.S. won't be able to pay or something of that sort. So that began in 2010. And we saw it, actually saw it. We saw central banks starting to buy gold. We went from liquidation of gold in the late 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, into a point at which there was no more liquidation sometime in 2004, 2005. And net buying began around 2010. And the net buying was significant, and it was spread. It wasn't just one country, it was different countries, many countries. That continued, and so that began and that became even more accentuated. I think the word should be maybe amplified, accentuated, in 2022 when the Allied forces froze Russian reserves. I think $300 billion worth of Russian reserves were frozen and were taken, and they did something that was really, I'm not passing judgment as to the war, the morality of the war or anything of that sort, but what they did was illegal, and it was really a violation of any kind of agreement or understanding that countries would have monetary agreements. I mean, it was a violation. So they froze it. When they did that, the pace, you can see that, the pace of buying increased, doubled. It almost doubled. And we went to about 240 tons a quarter or something of that sort. That continued from 2022. And now something very interesting happened. Again, it's almost unconscious. It's something not directed, not managed. There's no conspiracy here. It's all done as it happens. It's happening, and this happening is not managed, not coordinated. The amount of gold that is being bought and the fact that the price is rising is starting to make gold a very important asset. And when at one point dollar gold reserves were worth maybe gold in reserves were worth maybe 5% or 6% of total reserves, we have now maybe we have reached 30% or more, maybe 33% of total reserves. And in some ways, it's beginning to exceed. It already exceeded euro reserves and central banks holdings, and it's competing with the dollar. So, unbeknown, in a way, unconscious of this thing is happening. What is happening? Well, what is happening is that gold is becoming a real asset, a real international asset. And in a fragmented world where you're never sure of treaties and agreements, anything is up for grabs. The fact that you own gold and you can put it in reserve and you can hold it in your country gives some of these countries more security. But because it's becoming more important, two things are happening, and this is important. One, there is now a strong interest on the part of the holders to see to it that it doesn't depreciate. You don't want to see your most important asset depreciate. So if 30% or 40% of your reserves are in gold, you don't want to see that price go down 25 or 30%. So that's important because now we have from indifference, 15 or 20 years ago they were indifferent, they didn't care. Now we have more than, no longer this indifferent. Now they are quite concerned about the fact that gold should not go down. That's number one. Number two, because it's becoming very important, it could serve, and this is something in the future, and I'm not making a prediction either, I'm just theorizing that because it's becoming such an important international asset, it could become in the future a basis for a revised monetary system if we ever had one. Not that we needed one, and not that it would have been good to have one. Even though people think that I'm a gold bug and that I'm in favor of a gold standard like we had in the 19th century or early 20th century, I don't think that works. And one of the reasons it doesn't work is because nobody will abide by it. I mean, you can have an agreement, but we know now that nobody abides by agreements. So it wouldn't work. It wouldn't make a difference whether if you committed to a $20 to $20 gold to for redemption, then $35, and then you break that commitment, and now you commit to a $300, or a $1,000 ounce commit. Those commitments are worth nothing. So you cannot really create a serious monetary standard with gold. However, it can happen. Why can it happen? Because it will become the most important asset that these countries have. The most important liquid asset that the world will have, and I'm talking about 50 to 100 central banks. And 50 to 100 central banks means 50 to 100 countries. The most important liquid asset they will have is gold. And so, on the basis of that, one can say perhaps another system or another monetary system can be built. It is becoming important, and that is itself a fuel for this bull market. It's fueling the bull market, and the bull market is fueling that idea that that is becoming more and more important as an international asset. I know I got a little bit too philosophical about it, but that is really underneath that is what's happening underneath this market. Yeah.
It is a philosophical, a theoretical
Right.
overview of the market. There is another dimension to the gold market, and that dimension, I think, is much more is would base be the right word. And what I'm referring to is the gambling culture that it seems to have become a part of. I mean, we live in a world where the ads that we used to see on television for toasters and cars have been replaced by ads to bet on baseball, on everything, on everything. And we have Poly Market now, and prediction markets now taking becoming a part of the central part of the culture. And we have a view amongst many young people that by gambling, by speculating and blurring the distinction between speculating and gambling on meme stocks is their only out from a world in which they can't generate enough income to escape whatever trap they see themselves in. The gold market, the two examples of the gold market being part, or the precious metals market being part of this gambling culture, I think, is that Tether has become a central, has become the largest aggregator of gold next to Poland, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, has become the central bank that's been the largest purchaser of gold over the past year. And Tether's buying of gold, coupled with the incredible rise of silver, which was only in brief periods regarded as a reserve asset, seems to speak of a gambling culture that surely is responsible, or perhaps not surely. I'm asking you this, seems to be responsible for the incredible rise that we've seen since the beginning of 2026. What's your take on that?
I agree very much with that idea of it being like a meme stock when it comes to silver. I think silver does not really have the kind of fundamentals that would justify the price that we have today. It is a meme stock. It is a stock that was created, the move was created in the social media, and it was fed by this idea that there is a relationship between gold and silver historically, which I mean, nonsense, because that relationship fluctuates anywhere between 8 to 1 gold to silver to 100 to 1. So you can't really say there was a relationship, but that's been historically that ratio, is 8 to 1 to 100 to 1. So, but fed on that, and visions of it going back to maybe 20 to 1 or so, or 25 to 1, it took off. It took off in the social media, and you had enormous buying of it. But in truth, there is no monetary value to silver. It hasn't been used as a monetary asset. The demand for silver will drop, is already dropping precipitously when it comes, for instance, for somebody's uses. Solar panels, for example, or they have to drop it. It's just too costly. So I think that you will, and more importantly, you'll see an enormous amount of recycling is taking place now. Smelting of silver, old silver, which normally accounts for, I don't know, 12, 15% of supplies yearly, we will be flooded with silver in the next year. And it will be an enormous amount of silver available. And so silver is clearly a game stock. You know, that's what it is, a meme stock. That's what it is. So it's just certainly at this prices. So I have no certain interest. Gold is different because the rise in the price of gold did not come from there. The rise came from central bank buying. And that they're not meme players. So the real concern about assets and the type of safe haven assets that they want to have, and that came from there. And because it came from there, it's not the same thing. Now, the public is joining in. We are getting people, as always the case, anything that's going up, you'll see people joining. But even today, the public joining in is not, is far from being the same factor in the market as the public is in the silver market. So there clearly is an element of meme-ness in silver and platinum and palladium. I don't see that in gold. I don't see that in gold. You know, there's always an element of people joining a bandwagon, and that's true also with NVIDIA. You know, there are people who, when NVIDIA was going up, they join in. But that is not the main driver. Not the main driver when it comes to gold. That's, so, by the way, that's one of the reasons why we got out. We got out a little bit below the highs, but we got out last week in the 90s. And I felt that at that point, it's just a game now. It's just a purely game. It could do well. It could do even better than gold, but I'm no longer comfortable with it. And I'm
Got it of
far more
silver.
comfortable with gold. Yeah.
Got it of
Yeah.
silver.
Yeah. Yeah. Got it also.
So your portfolio now is concentrated to what extent in gold?
Our leverage, our exposure has about 1.9 times capital in gold. 1.9 times capital, right? Our total leverage is about 2.6 or something like that to GABA. So a good portion of the total is gold.
And what else is there?
Well, we have a position in oil, where I think that aside from the potential war problem existing, I think that the oil market is in a good technical position. Cracks are good, spreads are market is in backwardation. The technicals look good, so we have a nice position. I believe that our position in oil is about. We have about a 30% or a 30% exposure to oil. And then I am short a bunch of different groups of stocks via baskets, let's say, right? Some of them are related to crypto, for example, Coinbase and Robinhood well, I mean, at one time it was MicroStrategy, but we got out of that because it basically got to our target of almost zero premium. But we also have Circle International. So let's say a group of stocks that are betting on the fact that crypto itself there's a loss of interest in there, especially like a broker like Robinhood or Coinbase, that we'll see volumes decrease significantly. So we're short there. We are short the private credit firms, the managers, the sponsors, Blackstone's, KKR, Apollo, because I believe the business model is no longer operative. I think that they took in an enormous amount of capital. And they put a lot of money to work in these credit deals, but they're being done, and the credit deals are not doing so well anymore. The market is beginning to see that there is no great returns. And the private equity side, they are no longer able to sell the quantity of units to create new funds, so that they're selling funds to each other, and they're doing secondary. So there's going to be a significant slowdown in earnings in that group, plus defaults in the credit side. And so I believe that that's a group that will do poorly over the next year. Yeah.
And by comparison to gold, how do those three themes compare?
Well, the leverage, I consider that to be a stock position in a way, because I believe there's some good rotation in the market. So there's still areas in the market that do well. We are long, by the way, interestingly, the only stock that we're long is Google. So which we think that it still has room to go up. So I believe that all these other positions today represent maybe, let's say gold is 1.9 times capital, and all the other positions are around 0.7. So altogether, we have a 2.6 leverage to capital.
So gold then represents really like two-thirds of the portfolio, roughly.
Yeah, maybe even a little bit more. Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more. So I think that leads us pretty directly into the extraordinary letter that you wrote to shareholders in the global in the funds, where you talk about your investment process, and you speak about the famous Loeb quote of putting very few eggs or all your eggs in one basket and then watching the basket very carefully.
Right.
It's an extraordinary claim that you're making. And the first thing that comes to my mind is to ask you, like, well, what is the difference between this extraordinary success and the tragically extraordinary failures of 2013 that followed the 2013 high? Because the process was the same. Or are you saying that now, in our dotage, I'm saying that respectfully, in our dotage, you developed a new investment theme after 2000 in the last 2 years? I can't see that. So unless you did, unless you changed, unless you've developed something completely new, what explains the difference?
The difference is fundamental, and I think we learned a lot from that experience. And it wasn't 1 year; it was something like 5 years almost. We were 5 years in the doldrums. First of all, we reduced significantly the amount of leverage that we used. That was very important to us. In the aftermath of the Great Recession, after we made a lot of money on that great financial recession in 2009, we allowed our leverage to go up to more than 8 to 1 in our portfolio. That was a very high leverage. And the idea at the time was I was operating under this notion that I could balance the portfolio. I could find enough good assets to go long and bad assets to go short, and I could match them. And if I can match them, and if I leverage it, I would do well. And this really was behind the entire period almost of those 5 years. Very high leverage, not necessarily playing in our only or best idea, but just betting on good ideas that we had, which we thought they were good. And good ideas meaning ideas that we thought that would go up, and good ideas that we thought would go, things would go down. And so we would be able to pair them, what do you call a pair trade. And we paired them. That's what we did. We paired them, a lot of those trades. So here was a mistake, two mistakes. One, the very high leverage. By the way, also, we worked on the assumption, which everybody works on still today, which we think is faulty, that there is such a thing as correlation, and that one can actually create uncorrelated portfolios. We thought that we can create uncorrelated portfolios. That, if you looked at the behavior and you can check, you can see what, well, if you did this, if you long here and you long here, but this is not correlated to this one, so you should be okay. We discovered that correlation doesn't exist. I mean, it exists up to a point and then it changes, and you don't know when it changes. It changes. So correlation doesn't save you. Preparing for a correlated portfolio won't save you.
You mean an uncorrelated portfolio?
Yeah, preparing so that you have an uncorrelated portfolio against this problem that when you have a sell-off, you're not going to lose because some things are not correlated to the others, not correlated to others. That wouldn't work. So, but we learned that the hard way. We learned the hard way that hedging doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Hedging is a form of it's a dubious practice. It's a practice that comes out of either ignorance or out of fear or out of not knowing, an agnosticism of some sort. So then you shouldn't be in the market. That's what it is. You shouldn't be in the market. You shouldn't be hedging. Hedging is not what you should do. What you should do is only play what you think is going to do well, and whether short or long. But hedging doesn't work. But we learned that too. And we used it quite a bit. And then high leverage, as I say, we began to learn that 8 to 1 was too high. We began to slowly lower the leverage. It took us years. So we brought down it to 5 to 1 and then 4.5 to 1 until we got to the point that we were comfortable with. And the point of comfort came between 2.5 and 3 to 1. That was comfortable. That gave us enough time to react. And then finally, the final piece is on the idea that we didn't have to play all the good hands. We had to play the best hands. And so we moved away from the idea of good hands. If we have lots of good hands going long, and lots of good hands going short, we should be able to make money. No, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. We can't tell you, no, we can't play good hands. We need to play best hands. And so that's how it changed. So it took about 5 years or 6 years to learn that, and not only to learn it, but to change your mental, psychological makeup. You're so used to doing business in a certain way, right? Now, the question was, how do you manage risk? Because the big talk in Wall Street is managing risk. What do you do about risk?
Well, that's right. I mean, the three levels of the way that risk is, there's only three ways that you can do it. You can adjust the leverage. You can diversify your risk into what you hope it will be uncorrelated assets, or you have to rely on timing. And timing is, unless you have a crystal ball or unless you have some kind of insect's antennae that can see the future, some kind of sensitivity that few humans have been endowed with, seems to be a very difficult game, but the game that you're left to play. How do you see it?
Yeah. So I submit that, I mean, you're right, that this strategy requires, or this tactic anyway, requires a high sensitivity to move quickly, very, very high sensitivity to moving quickly. So it starts with the idea that, fortunately, in this orderly world, I think in some ways still orderly, for the trend is your friend. So if a trend began, and under certain conditions, and I don't mean just a trend, technically speaking, but fundamentally speaking, a certain trend began in a certain direction, a certain way. So that trend will continue until it stops, but it doesn't stop suddenly. There are factors that begin to appear that will cloud the picture, and the trend will start showing a certain exhaustion. Whether it's fundamental or technical, there's certain exhaustion. One of the exhaustion points is failure to react. If it no longer, I'm going to give you a very simple example, right? You're long an ice cream maker. I'll take anything. And you think that, you know, the expansion of this market is tremendous, and you're calculated that, you know, they're going to be selling enormous amounts, and the trend is your friend and it's happening. This company is selling an enormous amount of ice cream, and it's growing and business is growing. And then comes the moment where they sold a lot of ice cream, but the stock is no longer reacting that way to it. It's like, you know, what else is new? It's like, now the power of the trend has diminished. And we're starting to see what you might call exhaustion. We may have seen it all already. We may have seen it's possible sometimes it doesn't happen that way, but we may. We have to be sensitive to those things that are beginning to show that the trend is changing. Now, I admit that besides that, so that's easier to do. That's easier to do. I mean, we will examine, for example, I can give an example, an easy example in our markets today. If I found out today that China decided no longer to buy any more gold, if I trust them, because I don't trust them necessarily, but let's say if I trusted them, and they came out with a statement, we are no longer buying gold. Well, that's a significant puncture in the trend, in the idea that central banks are accumulating gold, right? Maybe if Poland decides they're not longer buying any gold. That's a problem. I should be sensitive to that. I'm only giving an example of the kinds of things that we should be sensitive to, because they were part of the trend. They were part of the idea. And so I have to be sensitive to that. So it does require a very high degree of sensitivity. But because you have few positions, you can concentrate. You can concentrate your thought. You don't allow it to be lazy. It's not as if you have 30 positions and something is not doing so well. And you say, well, you know what, not doing so well, but the rest is doing well. So I'll forget about it. I can't forget about it, right? If this thing doesn't work well, I'm going to lose a lot of money very quickly. So I have to be very sensitive. I have to be on my toes. There's another kind of thing that can happen, which is an unusual piece of news. I mean, there could be, and now I'm just going to invent something, but what happens if we reach the moon and we find that the moon is covered with gold? It's like suddenly, you know, we get there and, oh my gosh, there is like 3,000 tons of gold here. Well, yeah, that's a piece of news that I couldn't possibly know. Nobody would know in advance. So even the trend that we were following didn't have that kind of possibility in there, right? That's something completely out of the picture. Like I almost you say an unknown unknown, an unknown unknown, right? Now, there, I say we still have a few hours or maybe a day or two to operate, because even in that commotion, you still have some people who are skeptical about it. Some people who will say, maybe it takes 5 years to get here. Maybe we don't have enough planes to bring it. There is still doubt in the early stage. I can operate in that stage, or I should be able to operate in that stage. And if I think that it's an important piece of news and that there is some significance to it, I have to deleverage and I have to begin deleverage quickly, right? So there is news that can affect the market, and there I can be caught. I think if those type of news came out, we would easily lose 20 or 25% of net asset value overnight, possibly. That's possible. It's probability says that those things don't happen so easy, so quickly, so, you know, so often, but it could. The other kind where there is some kind of weakening of the trend because things are happening, I have to be alert to that. And that won't allow me to lose that much. I think I can deleverage on the way so that we don't lose that much, right?
But there's a third kind of risk. Which often is, you have markets that collapse without any narratives at all. You could have the gold market. I can envision a gold market dropping 30%, and then after the 30% drop, news of that the Polish bank is no longer buying gold, or that China has stopped its reserve buying process. You don't find out the news until after the fact. How do you deal with that?
Well, you mean it went down.
Yeah, often markets change direction, especially speculative markets like the one that we're in now, change directions very violently. And the reason for the change doesn't
occur. But not for no reason.
Well, you don't know the reason. You can hear, you know, there's certainly like reporters will interview traders and they'll get all kinds of theories. But you really don't know the reason until well after the fact. And you have to discern. You have to be able to parse amongst the various narratives what is true and what isn't true.
Right.
And if you still fundamentally are attached to the thesis which propelled you into the market to begin with, and there is no news that violates that thesis, you're paralyzed there. By definition, you're paralyzed.
There is no news, and there is no and the market is, but the market, for example, is reacting to something, not reacting to, you're saying it's reacting to nothing, to absolutely nothing.
No, it's not reacting to absolutely nothing. It's reacting to something that's explained, but it's not in any way a violation of the thesis that drove you into the market to begin with. It says that
there is a reason, but the reason doesn't seem to justify the decline. In that case, you're right. In that case, I would say there's nothing to worry about. If the reason that is being offered doesn't justify the decline, I would say then I am probably going to stay. I'm probably going to stay.
I think that you could find that if that is what happens, you may find out that then, after the fact, that some of the reasons that you got into to begin with are starting to change. Then you can see, for example, a statement from a Polish bank saying, in light of the decline of the price of gold, we've decided to withdraw, to scale back our purchases. Meanwhile, like the price has declined a lot since then.
But we would know pretty quickly. It could be. I mean, I'm not denying it. It could be, but it we would know pretty quickly. Within 2 days, we would probably know. It's hard to keep a secret of some important piece of news. I mean, you had pieces like that where Mario Draghi said, "We'll do whatever he needs, whatever it takes." And the first few hours, nobody really knew the implications of that. We didn't even respect the implications even a week later. But you have some kind of statement that you have to see whether, well, maybe, this is an important statement. We'll do anything that it takes to save the euro. Okay, now you have to worry about it, probably. But I don't think that you would have a substantial enough decline, and I'm saying more than 10% decline, without knowing something about what caused the decline. And if the something that you find out is nonsensical, then you stay. But if it that makes sense, if it starts to make sense, then you have to get out. But it is difficult. But the point is, you're giving up. You're giving up. You don't want to give up the possibility of making so much. So what happens is, let's say you made 100% because you were very concentrated. You made 100%. You have to be prepared then to still lose 20 or 25%. You still had 75%. Those things don't happen often, but they do happen, of course. And when they do, you have to. So depends how much am I willing to give up for that possibility of making what I see is a very good trade.
Fair
Yes.
enough.
So that's why I meant to say that I don't anticipate the risk. I try to deal with it after it begins, after the risk has taken place. Yeah.
Understood.
Yeah.
Understood.
Yeah.
Gerald Loeb's statement is your it was your father who your late father who gave you Gerald Loeb's famous statement of putting all your
Yeah,
eggs
he
in
told
one
me about it. He
basket.
said he had read it, and he told me that statement. He liked that statement, and I was young, and I didn't know anything about diversification. I didn't even understand what diversification was, but I understood that idea that if you have a small amount of positions or a little bit, and then you watch it very closely, you don't allow yourself to be lazy about it. It's easy to become lazy. We as managers are constantly fighting our own minds, our own psychology. I mean,
Yeah, of course.
it's all a question of psychology, right? And we are
Yeah, of
constantly
course.
fighting our own psychology. We have to give ourselves the least amount of opportunities to allow ourselves to deceive ourselves. And one of them is
Well,
if I have 30 stocks and one of them is not doing so well, do it, well,
that's
maybe,
true.
something happened, But that's not good.
I take your point. Your father, I think it was your father, who told me once that what one should buy, one should always be a buyer of gold with the hope that it goes down. With the hope that it goes down. The reason obviously being that the price of gold reflects the danger level in the world. Price of gold is the thermometer is rising at a very rapid clip. In your mind, does it reflect a danger level that can imperil assets elsewhere?
I
Imperiling
don't think it's
assets,
clear.
maybe the least of our worries, it
Yeah,
could be, I
yeah.
mean, we're talking about.
I don't think it's predicting any disaster. I think it's paralleling or reflecting what is happening actually. And what's happening is a fragmentation, as I said before, and also the fact that people don't want to hold cash anymore. And you can see what's interesting is that gold is going up as the stock market is going up. This is a first. In the past, gold and stock market took up
Yes.
opposing directions, right? They're not anymore doing that. That means that we're not necessarily predicting a disaster. I don't think that has to be. It just means that there is a redistribution or reallocation or change in the way people are holding assets. That's all it means.
So you don't feel that it's a form of nihilism,
No.
impending nihilism, no.
No. No. No.
Okay.
Not at all. And especially look at the bond market. I mean, you know, you can borrow enormous amounts of money, I mean, the governments can, at very fair rates. So nobody, I mean, it can't be that we are worried about the end of the world when such a large portion of the market is so calm, so stable. So it's not, I think it's just a reflection, and it's a change in composition of your assets. It's a change in the portfolio, in the global portfolio. There's a compositional change in global, just like there is a change in the composition of the portfolios in the U.S. market itself. People went for this high tech, you know, AI. 50. I just saw 50 companies accounted for 70% of all the gains in the S&P in the last 5 or 10 years. Just 50 companies. So, you didn't have a disaster accompanying that either. Other stocks went down and this went up, and so we have just a change in the composition of portfolios. That's all. I don't see that as a disaster predictor. As a predictor.
Al, congratulations on an astounding 2025, and so far an astounding 2026. On behalf of all of us who are investors in the fund, wish you all the best, good health, and continued success. Thanks. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your time this morning.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.